Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jake. It's lovely to be here.
I'm very excited for today because it's an opportunity for me to turn the tables slightly. Often when we have an appointment, you're the one asking all the questions. And so we're going to switch that around slightly today. But I'll start very simply. You are a homeopath. What is homeopathy?
This is a big question, really. But I will start with going right back to the beginning at the founding of homeopathy by a doctor called Dr. Samuel Hahnemann. And he was born in Germany in the mid-1700s. And he was actually a medical doctor. And he then, actually when he graduated medicine, he didn't really like the way that medicine was going back then. He thought, this is all really weird and wrong. At the time, they were doing what was called heroic medicine, which meant bloodletting and using mercury and things like that. And he really felt like, oh, this just is not right. And so he actually didn't continue with practicing as a doctor. He was a very, very clever man, and he had a job. He spoke 11 languages, and he got a job translating medical textbooks. And so back then he was translating a medical textbook, and he noticed that it was on poisonings, actually. And he noticed that there was a certain type of bark from a tree that, when in its poisoned form, was causing symptoms that looked a lot like malaria. And he was thinking, that's really interesting. So if you have too much of that bark somehow, because probably it was being used as a herbal medicine, then it looks like you have malaria. How interesting is that? And, you know, through, you know, his intuition, most likely, he went, I wonder what happens then if we reduce the dose of that bark, like what happens? And what happens if you were to give that bark to someone with malaria? Okay, so, and this kind of brought about one of the main laws of homeopathy, which is the principle of like cures like. So we give the same substance. I'm going to use a really, really easy example, and that's coffee. And so if you have too much coffee, you know, your heart will race, you might get a bit hot, you won't be able to sleep, you might get a bit anxious, you might get a little bit sweaty. And if somebody presents in our clinic like that, we can give the remedy made from coffee, which is called coffea. And it's almost like it cancels out the symptoms. The thing is, we're not giving coffee in a crude form. We're giving coffee in a minute dose. So we take the coffee and we dilute it over to a different potency. We have very different potencies, but we dilute it in a series of dilutions. And in between those dilutions, we do what's called succussion, which is banging the remedy. Samuel Hahnemann used to do it against a book, the Bible, most likely. And this kind of energizes the remedy. And so homeopathy is an energetic medicine because sometimes we're working with dilutions that are much, much higher than it is known that it still holds a material dose. However, there is a lot more research coming out about ultra-high dilutions and how water actually carries the energy of a substance. And, you know, there's so much out there at the moment about water, actually, and all the phases of water, and also the very interesting nature of water. There's a lady from New Zealand called Veda Austin who's doing a lot of research and showing how water carries memory. So basically that's what we're doing. We're taking a substance, we prepare it in a dilution in a very systematic way, and we see what that remedy is for, or what that substance is for homeopathically. And we give it to a patient that comes that may be producing the symptoms of that. So Samuel Hahnemann, he started experimenting with this. It's called China officinalis. He started experimenting with this bark of the tree and taking it himself and taking it and then diluting it. And then he started to give it to people with malaria. And he noticed that it cancelled out their symptoms. So this is kind of the premise. He also took, we also have another major law, I guess, of homeopathy, which is the law of minimum dose, which is really how much do we need to give to a person to heal them? How much of a substance do we need to give? And for example, with Panadol or paracetamol, at a very high dose, we know it can kill you. At a certain dose, it can, you know, take away inflammation in your body, okay? And then there's a dose where it will do nothing. So there's this kind of scale of dose. It's a principle called hormesis. And actually Paracelsus talked about this principle a long time ago as well. How much of a substance do we need for it to be curative? And so it kind of homeopathy turns the whole thing on its head, because previously we thought it had to be a huge material dose for something to be curative, but it doesn't always. And that's what we see with homeopathy, that we can give a patient that remedy in a certain potency, and that will start the body actually bringing itself back into balance. Because we also talk about the vital force, and the vital force is what animates us. And if you think when we're born and the intelligence of the body in starting to grow, starting to form limbs and organs, like this magical alchemical process that happens from one cell, it turns into a human being. There is an animation to that, and that is the vital force, knowing what it needs to be doing. So basically homeopathy is all about working with the vital force as well. It's not working against it. It's not squashing things down. It's not taking away. We don't kill things like antibiotics and even herbal medicine can do. We don't work like that. We work with the body. And so we give it a little flick or a little nudge with a remedy saying, we can see the symptoms. Here is the substance. Now you do the healing yourself. So it can be very fast, and it can be a process of peeling back layers to understand or to get to a place of healing. It really just depends on where somebody is and what level of health they already have. So that's it awesome. In a nutshell. You might have questions.
Well, that was amazing, Sarah. Thank you. I have literally like jotted down 10 or so things, which would probably make a 10-part series in themselves. But in just the 60 minutes, we'll try and work through it. And I think what would be fun is to continue almost like a timeline process. So you started roughly the mid-1700s. Take us through to like how homeopathy developed, how it spread around the world. And I'll then bring up some of the stuff. I brought my most recent prescription from you, and we'll take one of them and just talk about how you came to the conclusion that that'd be a good idea for me. But mm-hmm. And I love this idea. So Hahnemann, you said his name was?
Yeah, Hahnemann.
Hahnemann, okay. 11 languages. I mean, that's just mad, isn't it? Yeah. You imagine how much, like mid-1700s, so you're about 100 years after the printing press was first created. So someone who's as close to that form of new technology is just hoovering up information, like mm-hmm. faster and broader than anyone else would have been. And then it's a case of like, how do you see the patterns? How do you draw the dots? And I love that kind of shit. Like, people are so smart. What happened after he made these connections? And try and paint a picture for us to how it developed.
So he then started making more remedies using this series of dilution and succussion. And he would take them himself. So he was experimenting on himself and developing, you know, all of his laws and principles. We actually have a book of homeopathy, which is our Bible, which is called The Organon of Medicine. And he, in all of this, he started forming these ideas. And, you know, it starts basically with first do no harm, which is principle of medicine. And then he talks about like cures like and the law of minimum dose. And then he goes into a whole lot of things, which it's in that language. It's actually quite challenging to read sometimes. But so he was developing all these ideas. He was practicing on himself. And then he started to probably just attract patients and started to, you know, practice on other people. So he became quite a big deal. But of course, and this is the thing with homeopathy too, even back then it became controversial at times. And even then medicine did not want him to speak about this or for this way to be practiced. He had a lot of people who were a bit like, well, a lot of skeptics for sure. But he persisted. I will have to say that if you ever see a picture of him, he has a really big cranium. So it was just a lot of brains going on in there. Anyway, so he continued in Germany, and then he actually went to France as well, and he started spreading the word in France, and he kept on going. A lot of medical doctors back then, they were all medical doctors, and he would train them, and still he had a lot of skeptics, but he managed to turn a lot of people when they saw some really, really impressive results with homeopathy. And so he had many students that followed him. And of course, when there's many students following the master, sometimes they develop their own ideas as well. And then they kind of want to take it where they want it to go. And so that's what happened a little bit as well. He had many students and they took it and wanted to and thought it should be like this or thought it should be like that. And again, there was a lot of controversy and skepticism. This is like the journey of homeopathy. So then, but homeopathy started spreading around the world. And actually homeopathy is known to be the second or third most used form of medicine in the world. In fact, in India, it's a huge part of their medical system. In Switzerland, it is in Sweden, in the UK, in Germany still, it's very, very, very common. And so it spread all over Europe and then to America as well. And I'm not sure when it spread to India and those places. Probably the British took it there. I'm not sure. And actually, there were homeopathic hospitals everywhere in the late 1800s, early 1900s. There was actually even a homeopathic hospital in Melbourne, Australia, up until the 1950s. And at that time, even the royal family always used homeopathy from the UK. A lot of the royalty in Europe used homeopathy. So, as it went on, there were many, 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 many students and many people who were kind of branching it out and, which were shut down by the other people, by the other students and all of that kind of thing. So if we kind of fast forward to the 1950s, say, and actually earlier in the 1900s, when especially in America, the medical association, actually there was a homeopathic association of homeopaths established in the US before there was a medical association, 2 years before, actually in the early 1900s. And the homeopaths knew that they need to kind of form an alliance and support each other and all of that kind of thing. And then the medical association came along and they wanted to really polarize with the homeopaths. And then, moving along from that, in the 1950s, I guess at that time, there could be a lot more money made in pharmaceuticals. And so it's probably the most successful campaign ever of a pharmaceutical company to wipe out homeopathy quite significantly. So since then, the homeopathic hospitals got closed down. I think it was only in London, because there's a homeopathic hospital in the centre of London that was the Queen's Hospital. That was more recently, probably in the last 5 years, its name was changed. And I can't remember what it was changed to. But in Australia, I can't remember when the hospital in Melbourne was closed down, but there were pharmacies everywhere, homeopathic pharmacies everywhere. And so here we are today, and actually homeopathy is having a resurge, that's for sure. I could speculate that may be related to people feeling a little disillusioned by our medical system, especially post-COVID or during COVID. A lot of questions came up for people. But homeopathy's always been there and it's been pretty solid. It's like we're survivors, really, because we do end up kind of getting a lot of skeptical suppression, actually, over the years. Yeah. That's
amazing, isn't it? You talk about results. And so let's do this now as a brief exercise. I'll take the first thing that you've prescribed me here. So, and just for those listening, I jumped on a call with Sarah recently. We spent an hour talking. We got to a place that I never expected to, actually, talking a lot around the grief that I'm still holding for the death of my father now over 15 years ago. And there's been all sorts of things going on for me over the course of even just the last couple of years, investing in personal development work and trying to, well, it's really what my podcast is about in many ways. You can invest in so many different things. That includes your health. And then in health, there's different subsections, you know, your mindset, your spiritual beliefs, and how you're functioning physically, just to name a couple. But the first thing you've actually prescribed me here is, so it says Ilex AQ Cephalinum Thymus Gland Mini Liquid. And it's five drops once a day for 3 days before starting all the other remedies. And it's for clearing the male ancestral line and responsibility and unearthing the grief that sits in the heart. Massive. I'm almost getting a bit emotional now. And the potency, you talked about this before already, 50 mg. So can you teach me, how did you come to the conclusion that that would be a useful thing for me to try as a use case for what you've just explained?
Okay, so that's quite an advanced prescription. So it goes a little, it's still like cures like, but for you, there's three remedies in that combination. And in homeopathy, we can work with our ancestral lineage and the mark, I guess, they made upon us and the mark that was left upon them. It's called miasm. And in this miasm, so miasms really are, it's almost like epigenetics, which genes were turned on from what kind of exposures. Okay, so one of the remedies in that triad there, that's called a triad, is Cephalinum. And Cephalinum is a miasm, and it basically is the pattern of illness that occurred. So we know that syphilis was an epidemic. People were dying of syphilis everywhere long, long time ago. All of our ancestors probably had some kind of relation to that, depending where they were. So you either died or you survived. But if you survived back then, you were generally survived through suppression of the illness. And when we suppress something, and this could have been if they were using mercury-based medications at the time, it pushes it into the cell. And the cell holds that memory. So then if you survive, you go and have children. And your children also hold that trauma in their cells. And then you go and have children and they hold it. But it doesn't present as syphilis anymore. It presents as, well, we see different patterns. And so the syphilitic pattern is actually, you know, and I know your father died of a heart attack and his father also. There's often heart attacks in these families. Wow. Early on. And so that's addressing that. It's addressing the grief. It's addressing this tendency of this pattern of physical illness and pathology. And also, you know, I know in your family too, there's been a lot of success. There's been a lot of expectation. There's been a lot of duty. And there's been, you know, we talked about that word when we spoke last time as well. And this remedy really, you know, there's also kind of high achievers. I think there's a high achieving vibe. And you were the firstborn as well, right? You carry this, you carry the essence of this profoundly. So within that remedy, basically I'm looking at unleashing you from that story, from that trauma that goes way back in your family. The other two remedies, one of them's thymus gland. So the thymus gland is the gland of the heart. And, you know, your father died of a heart attack and his father died of a heart attack. The thymus gland stores the memory of trauma as well. So the thymus gland, it's also a center of immunity for our bodies when we're young. And it sets up our immune system really to respond to illness. But later on, it also stores a lot. And so giving you that remedy in the combination with the Cephalinum is also to help release it from your heart. And then the remedy Ilex, which is a plant, this remedy is all about the father's inherited line. It's about all the things that you couldn't say to your father or that he couldn't say to you. It's about trauma that's handed down through the male line. And where things were cut short. So those three remedies, as I said, like this is not a straightforward prescription. I've known you in the family for a long time.
It's also, it's intense. Like I'm sitting here and I can feel the energy on the back of my neck going up and my head, and I'm getting a bit like short of breath and
amazing.
Oh, it's wild because, and you just don't expect to find yourself having these conversations. It's like, what do you mean you can play around with the ancestral trauma?
Yeah.
What the hell is that? An area of this I'd love to highlight as well is when having a session with you, there comes this point where you almost stop receiving information and you go, okay, and you just tune in. Mm-hmm. So what is that? And how does that help you? Like some kind of guide or source or spirit or however you might describe it. I'd love to learn more about that.
Yeah. And so that's not homeopathy. That's me.
I understand. That's then your skill as a practitioner in some ways. And again, we'll come back to this idea of progress, but where does that come from? Because that must have been we mentioned Hahnemann, right? The different inspirations he's taking from places. That's what we all do all the time, is you're combining different things from different places to see if it works.
Yeah, right. So I have a long history. I guess, going back to when I was fairly young, I would say I noticed a lot of things. And I would always say to my mum, oh, but I saw that, or and she'd be like, no, you didn't. And so, I already felt like I was quite intuitive, but I just actually thought it was just weird and that I just shouldn't talk about those kind of things. Mm. And then when I was 16, I was at boarding school and I got really ill. And it turned out I had viral meningitis. Well, they think I did. They never confirmed with the lumbar puncture for some reason, but I was in hospital for a while and then I couldn't attend school for a while. But during this time, I was having a lot of information coming to me. And at the time it was, it was quite intense actually. And I didn't tell anyone because I just thought, I don't know, I was just in it. Because often it had come at nighttime and it'd be, grief or sadness or something, but I knew it wasn't mine. It was coming from other images and things. The thing about viruses really, really speed up our evolution. But we also know that viruses can trigger consciousness, and that perhaps it was a virus that triggered human consciousness in the beginning. Wow. In the expansion of human consciousness. And that's the only way I can explain what was happening. I don't know what virus I had. So going forward, put that aside, did a science degree, shut down that part of me. Nothing does that. Nothing shuts down your intuition like a science degree. it shouldn't though. Samuel Hahnemann could work it out, but I'm definitely not him. And so, but I have a long history with meditation. And so I have a long history with being quiet with myself and sitting in and noticing. And I attended an ashram for many years as well. And we had a process that we did solely individually. And we also did it within a group. And this kind of really tuned me into knowing what's in the field. Because when we would do it in a group, we would all pick up on what was happening with one person, for example. So that was really fine tuning about picking up a deep knowing of what is in the field for that person at that point in time. And so when I'm with somebody now, I get all the information. I get all the left brain stuff. We go into that. I mean, there's always both sides of my brain kind of firing at the same time. But when I close my eyes or I ask my client to close their eyes, it's just to shut down that left brain, to shut down that logical, I'm just going to explain my symptoms to you, and really feel what else is here. And that's when I'll get ideas, or I will ask questions, or I will, get a strong feeling. I've had in my experience some quite strong feelings. I also work a lot with autism and a lot of nonverbal children, and to work with them to get more symptoms, this is something that I use in order to kind of really gain a whole understanding. Because in homeopathy, it's not just about tell me your symptoms. You've got this sore toe and it's worse when you're at nighttime or when it's cloudy. It's it's, you know, as you know, going really deeply into your ancestry, going deeply into how you experience the world. And so people can tell us a lot, but sometimes there's something else that sits there that they're not quite aware of. So that's why I do it. It's almost like I'm trying to speed up the process, and things will come to me. And so I'll ask someone, what about this? What about that? And it'll either resonate with them or it won't. And I'll decide from there through intuitive testing or sometimes muscle testing if it's important for me to know that in preparing a prescription for somebody. So, yeah, that's why I do that, really. I find for me that I get a much deeper insight when I close my eyes and I guide somebody else into a meditation state or a non-ordinary state, we can call it as well, where it's not just describing symptoms, it's about what the symptoms are like for that person.
It's so cool, Sarah. It's like another dimension of communication that people aren't even aware exists. And the average person on the street, if they were to be listening to this conversation, be like, these guys, what are they talking about? You know, very dismissive. And I would hazard a guess that your science degree contained, if lucky, like 1% of information talking about this kind of thing. So it's obviously a case of you with a very strong sense of, it's like natural talent in some ways, isn't it? It just wants to come out. But maybe we could give some examples then of some progress or some results that have been achieved through using this set of skills that you've picked up. So what are some of the things that come to mind where you're like, well, that was a pretty crazy scenario that person was in, and we were able to get them from here to there?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm thinking of a strong, particularly strong symptom that came through in a case with a lady who I'm working with who has Crohn's disease, which is basically a gut illness where the gut doesn't absorb anything. It's so inflamed all the time that it's very difficult to absorb food. So they'll either have a chronic diarrhea state or chronic inflammation in the body. And so she was talking and telling me her symptoms, and she's quite intuitive as well, but this particular day she was very distressed. And I said to her, and she talks about her family history and about, you know, her mother and her father and the trauma and all of those things that she went through and her extended family. Anyway, I said, there was a lot of information coming at me. So I said, I just need to close my eyes for a minute to work. Really, it's to work out where do I need to go next with all of this information that's coming, what's important right now. And in that case, I closed my eyes and straight away I felt somebody over my left shoulder. This is where it gets really wacky. And it was like they were stabbing me in the back. And I said to her, I'm just going to tell you what I see, but there's someone stabbing me in the back. And I didn't physically turn, but in my mind I turned to look at them, and they kind of stood back like this, like they'd been caught doing something bad.
Oh, I've just got a serious shiver.
Yeah, I felt a little bit frightened at this because it was so dark and so hidden, which is representative of another miasm, a different miasm. And then I just asked, and you know, who are you? Who is this? Whose energy is this? And it was her auntie. That's what I got straight away. And so I told her what I saw, and she was just like, whoa. She was like, I think her aunt was always jealous of her mum, and the grandmother always played the two, her mum and their aunt, off against each other, and all this kind of weird stuff. But what happened was I then thought, okay, what am I going to do with this information? So we have a book in homeopathy which lists a lot of symptoms and the remedies that associated with those symptoms. It's called a repertory. And so I thought, I'm going to look at the repertory for the delusions, because this was a delusional state, which can also be a non-ordinary state, of being stabbed in the back. And within that, there was a remedy called Rusk Labra. And Rusk Labra has all of these gut issues, and they have a delusion they're being stabbed in the back. And so I gave her that remedy, and This did not solve her entire case, because there's many, many layers, and we're working on mold now, actually, which is a big thing. But it actually kind of unhinged her from that trauma part of her story. Wow. So since then, it's almost brought her into the present, so that now we are we're talking about her physical symptoms. We're dealing with mold and mast cell activation and these kind of things, but we haven't had to. She hasn't brought that kind of onslaught of all of the family trauma and history to the case taking anymore. Crohn's is a very complex disease state, so we work in these layers and we give the remedies, and whether it's for trauma or the physical symptoms and all of that kind of thing, we try to kind of that to be all encompassed in the prescription. There's another case of a child that was getting croup all the time, like all the time. And the mother was every time the croup came up, the mother would go into a real fear, panic, stress response. And I gave all the remedies that were indicated for this type of croup that this child had, and a fear and panic remedy for the mother as well. Those things, they helped a bit, but he would still get croup. And what we want to do with homeopathy is resolve this issue of why this illness keeps coming back. We want to get to the root of why it is. And sometimes that's not just in the physical body or in the immediate surroundings. And so I took the mother into a process where I got her to close her eyes. And she was talking about, I asked her about, you know, what it felt like when she was really anxious when her child had croup. So we were talking about both of them. She was talking about burning, panic, racing. And at that point, as she's talking, I saw a woman holding a child surrounded by flames. This woman was in complete panic, and there were flames and smoke all around them. And so I gave a remedy called carbon monoxide, a remedy made from carbon monoxide, for this child and for this mother, for both of them, actually. And the child has not had croup since that prescription. And the mother is, her anxiety levels have reduced immensely, because she was not only getting anxious when that son got croup, but when her other children also got croup. But that child, and this was, he was getting croup from when he was like one until he was three, consistently. And yeah, it was, you know, the remedies were helping him when he had it, but we just didn't want him to have it anymore. So since this prescription, he hasn't had croup again.
Awesome. Well done. Wow. And so I'm intrigued then. So this idea of the mother and the child surrounded by flames.
Yeah.
Could it be that that was a situation that an ancestor of the mother was in, that's just in the cells, right?
Yep.
And it's now manifesting in physical reality multiple generations later.
Yeah.
Really? Yep.
Or past life. There's actually a really amazing homeopath. She's French, and she does past life regressions, and she talks about a case that she was working with for years and not really helping this client. And she was always thinking, gosh, I don't know why this client keeps coming back, because I don't feel like I'm helping her. So she did a past life regression, and the client actually saw herself in a concentration camp in the Second World War.
Wow.
And they went through all this trauma and what was coming up, and then she asked the client, you know, what's the worst thing about this situation? And the client said, it's the gas chamber. And so the homeopath gave her hydrocyanic acid, cyanide, which was what they were using. And this client got better after that. Yeah.
Wild, isn't it?
It's wild. You know, she was working on the client for years, and yeah.
So talking of past lives, Janine Kim, I think, is a friend of yours. Yeah. So Janine's actually joining the podcast tomorrow, which is cool. So we'll dive into that subject with her about how that connects and some of the work we've been doing together with Loz and I. An area that you've touched on already, this relationship between the parent and the child. So something just to run through, which I think would be cool for the audience as well, is, again, using myself as a use case, like as parents of now three kids, Loz probably speaks to you, I don't know, every couple of months at least about every one of us. Mm-hmm. And you've been an amazing help to us. Thank you for navigating the trials and tribulations of having young kids. And, you know, every night now after teeth are brushed, it's like book time and I've got mine and then my two girls and all their remedies lined up and we go through them all and take them every day, like religiously if we can. But a big subject for us to get our heads around just at the start was like, okay, there's an infant vaccine program in Australia and the government recommends that you do X, Y, Z. And I think that we did the first set up to 8 weeks and the impact on our first daughter was so strong and my wife's intuition was so strong. She's like, I'm never doing that again unless I find out as much as I can about these things. And we actually haven't given any to any of our children since. So it was quite a big change for us and a big moment where it's like, actually, we're going to say, no, this doesn't make sense for us. And it's caused us problems in a number of areas because they make it difficult for you. You know, none other than the fact that like the no jab, no play rule. So you can't get into publicly funded childcare without doing what the government suggests. But a big part of that was finding out about the homeoprophylaxis program that Dr. Isaac created. Mm-hmm. And this actually plays in really nicely to how you explain why homeopathy works, which is, of course, there are diseases out there that you do not want your child getting, and they are a real risk. Mm-hmm. But we were able to use homeopathics and give a homeoprophylaxis program, as it's described, for kids to protect against some of the most dangerous things. Now, ironically, we can't go to the childcare system and be like, look, here's our homeopathic program we've done. We're just as well protected. We're comfortable with that as parents. They're like, no, no can do. But teach us about what homeoprophylaxis is and why those programs have been effective for people. As you described, we're helping the body work with the body and we can still get the benefits of protection without some of the, I mean, to be honest, very questionable side effects of what might be in some of those vaccines. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Isaac Golden, he is an Australian homeopath, PhD doctor. He got his PhD in homeoprophylaxis and he actually had a vaccine damaged child. And at that time, he, of course, looked into everything and started researching. And he was already a homeopath at that time, or maybe not quite a homeopath, but, and so he started to look into, you know, what can we do with homeopathy? Actually, Samuel Hahnemann had already spoken about using homeopathy prophylactically in the 1800s when there was scarlet fever outbreak epidemic, actually. And he found that there was a remedy that was very useful for the patients, for the people that were getting scarlet fever, that was belladonna. And so he was giving that remedy to a lot of people and they were recovering well. And so, and he thought, again, download from wherever, what if I give this remedy to people before they actually get the illness? Mm-hmm. Can we protect them? And so he rolled that out almost like a research study during an epidemic by giving people belladonna, because at the time there was nothing that anyone was able to do. And the statistics on the success of doing that were so significant. And so, you know, fast forward 200 years later or whatever, and Isaac Golden having this situation as well with a vaccine damaged child, not wanting to vaccinate his children, but wanting them to be protected, decided to also do a research study and did his PhD. Now, he's been collecting data on this for 40 years. But basically it's for the main illnesses that we know can cause, you know, that can be very serious if they were to be contracted. The diseases in his main program are meningococcal, pneumococcal, haemophilus influenza B, tetanus, and whooping cough. Mm-hmm. So what the program does is provide the remedies to children in a series of dosages and things to help protect them against. Now, Dr. Isaac, as I mentioned, he's got 40 years of data on working like this with children, and he has found that the homeoprophylactic remedies are 85 to 95% effective in preventing the disease or preventing serious cases of any of these diseases, which is incredibly impressive. The thing with homeoprophylaxis, it's not a vaccination as such. It is about reducing the body's susceptibility to that disease. So it gives the body the message. Vaccination, inoculation is getting the immune system to mount a response and develop antibodies to a disease, whereas homeoprophylaxis is about getting the body to go, oh, I know that disease. We don't have to show you all the symptoms. I've got it. I know what I'm doing here. That's what the Vital Force does with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes when children have the homeoprophylactic remedy, they may have a slight reaction, which could be a slight immune reaction. It generally means they might have a susceptibility to that illness. But they recover and their immune system's fine. The thing about it as well is that we're not all susceptible. You know, COVID went around and not everyone got it. Most people got it, but some people didn't get it. And those people that didn't get it, they're not susceptible to it for whatever reason. Some people got it 8 times, other people got it once. You know, it's all about susceptibility. So we all have different susceptibilities, and also homeoprophylaxis works on those susceptibilities. So it's about reducing, if there is a susceptibility, it reduces that susceptibility to that illness. Isaac has also since then been invited to different countries. I think it was probably the early 2000s, he was invited to go to Cuba because they started using homeopathy. They had the embargo and they couldn't get all the vaccines there. So actually they make vaccines within the country, but they also were using homeopathy. And so they did a population-based trial, not particularly intentional, but basically they knew that they had a really severe season coming up where they were going to be susceptible to leptospirosis, which is a bacterial infection, which happens during the tornado. What are they called? The hurricane season in Cuba. And so they kind of had, they broke up the country and gave one whole area the homeoprophylaxis, the homeopathic remedy, and other area got the vaccine because they only had a small quantity of the vaccine. So, but statistically in that there were no other controls other than it was by region. But statistically, the region that had the homeoprophylactic remedy, it was so significant that you could not deny that this was like, wow, this is so much more effective than the vaccine was.
Wow.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, that kind of research, was taken to some major medical journals that just didn't really want to know about it.
No. Well, and that's where you have to, it's not even speculation at this point, but like the incentive model that's behind all of this stuff is just wild. Yeah. And that's not, we don't need to dig into that on the podcast now per se, but it's certainly been such an eye-opening few years as to how government and the pharmaceutical industry work together to get what they want. And like the idea that a vaccine, for example, is actually not liable. So the vaccine manufacturers, if you get in trouble, it's the government that has to bail them out. And it's written in law. And there's all of these different areas you can find information about why people like investing in vaccines, because they can't get any cost, essentially. The downside risk is very small. I guess I couldn't encourage people more to go out there and ask these kind of questions and have the kind of conversations like we're having right now, because the results are fantastic. And this very specific use case, right? Oh my God, you're not vaccinating your children. Like, people really find that very confronting. It's like, okay, Well, yes. And we've got a number of reasons for doing that. And is it not our right as people, as individuals, to choose what goes into our body? This idea that like public health policy is more important than individual choice, very, very dangerous area to be pushing agendas. We spent, I think, $200 on a box of remedies that three kids later we're still using a couple years down the line. It's like, and it's thus far, touch wood, worked. And it gives us something to be like, no, we haven't just not done it because we're, you know, you can call us conspiracy theorists or whatever you want. It's actually, we've been proactive about it and found a different solution that we preferred. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to argue with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, going back to the vaccines, you have to do what you're comfortable with. But what one of the problems is that you can't have a conversation with many people in the Western medical world about it. It's just you have to do it. And as I work extensively with autism, with neuroimmune disorders, PANS, PANDAS, all of that kind of thing. And I can't tell you the amount of parents who have said to me, I know my child changed after that vaccine.
Wow.
And the repercussions of that on that family,
it's just awful,
is
isn't it?
Beyond. When there's complete denial, and I will not say that vaccines cause autism because I've also seen autistic children that are not vaccinated, but our children are bombarded with a whole lot of toxins even before they enter the world, and then that can be the cherry on the top. You know, it's a factor. It's a contributing factor. And because we just roll it out just as a blanket rule for everybody, we have this situation where we have a growing rate of not only neuroimmune disorders, but autoimmune disorders, you know, in children. Like it's just, it's crazy, really. And then you're not allowed to speak about it, which is also crazy. Like, can we just have the conversation? Because I have a great deal of respect for Western medicine when it's used appropriately. I absolutely do. We need it. We need all of these ways of healing. Yet, you know, it's so interesting that one has to try to dominate and suppress and squash the others. And when it's not particularly, you know, if I wasn't helping people, I wouldn't continue to be a homeopath. You know, I wouldn't do it. I'd get bored of that because, you know, you can't do something without any results, right? And just take people's money. Well, some people maybe can, but I can't. And I think that, you know, this is an effective form of medicine, that we can do so much. And also, like with children, the more we use homeopathy, the more we strengthen their vital force. The more as adults we use homeopathic medicine, the more we strengthen the vital force. We are, any remedy that you give at any time is strengthening the vital force. I know that for sure. I've had a medical doctor in from India who has a homeopathic hospital in India, who I went to a seminar of his in New York 10 years ago or something. And he said the statistics of the cases of illness in children that are vaccinated compared to unvaccinated. And it's significant. Like it's extraordinarily different that, you know, the kids that are always getting these colds and coughs, and this is a normal part of being a child, to get a cold and a cough and a fever and those things. We need a child to have to go through that. We need their immune system to kind of go through things. But when we have children who are constantly in that kind of chronically ill state where they're constantly, you know, getting ill, sick, and their immune system can't quite recover, and then they might go and get more antibiotics because, in, you know, it all layers up, or steroids in many cases, then their immune systems are being suppressed. Their vital force is being suppressed. And so I think the more that you can use a well-rounded approach, use Western medicine when it's needed, and then look at the other options for supporting your child through a cold and flu and fever and things like that, because there's many.
Well, and to very happily promote something that you've helped us with, we have a small wooden box downstairs with about, I don't know, what, 20, 25 different remedies in, and a little booklet. And it's like, runny nose, take this one. Irritable from a bee sting, take this one. And it goes with us everywhere. And the first thing we'll do if we see any kind of symptoms popping up is like, remedies, remedies, remedies. Like my son is 6 months old, and he's now teething at nighttime. And, you know, Lauren, have you given him the remedy? Exhausted at like 4 a.m. It's like, no, I can't find it. Where's the Belladonna? You know, or whatever it is. And that's an incredible tool. So that's a great product that people can jump on your website and go and find. Mm-hmm. But Sarah, I'm intrigued. A final question before we close up. It's come up a few times, this idea of vital force. But what always fascinates me is what motivates people. So you just touched on the fact that you wouldn't feel comfortable taking someone's money and not seeing progress. So what is it that keeps bringing you back to taking on patients and carrying on doing what you do?
So especially because I work with children and their families. That's my passionate area. So I love learning, and I'm always learning. I'm learning from my clients, and I'm, you know, learning from the books, and I'm learning from the masters and all the time, you know, and I really love that. I feel like homeopathy actually has helped me understand the world, because we can see in every living thing a particular kind of imprint or energy to it, which I just find completely fascinating. And the other thing is that my oldest son, he had a lot of behavioral challenges as a child, and he was partially vaccinated, and then I stopped, and then I woke up, and then I started studying homeopathy actually. And he, you know, he went through, and he was actually a very well child, but he had a lot of behavioral challenges, and I saw a lot of homeopaths for him who prescribed just in a constitutional way. And it helped him a little bit, but it didn't quite resolve. And I eventually found that he probably had something that's called PANDAS, which is an autoimmune condition, which basically affects the child in that they start having huge anxieties. They can have tics. They can have rage. And he had a lot of these interesting behaviors that nobody could seem to work out. And so, like any kind of mama bear, you know, we start to really research.
Ask questions, yeah.
And I was a homeopath, and I just started to go in. And then I heard about PANDAS. I was working with a naturopath who'd started working with it over 10 years ago. And so, you know, now I love working with the immune system. I also feel like, and I saw him heal, and I saw him get much better. And then I started working with clients, and, you know, clients that had done all the biomedical or Western medical treatment, and just seeing that with one remedy, that child, you know, I had so many parents saying, I just gave them a dose and I feel like I've got my child back. Because with this illness, it's almost like it overcomes them. And this illness is a result of years of generations of toxicity and poor diet and, you know, all of these kind of things, leaky gut, and that leads to a leaky blood-brain barrier. And when I see that, and when I hear a parent say, you know, I gave that remedy and I got my child back, like that's my motivation.
Awesome. It's just
like a lot of the stories that of the families that I work with, these beautiful, beautiful people who are seeing their children go through things that, you know, no parent would want to see their child go through. That these children, our children, are the canaries in the coal mine of these years of layering up toxicity and you know, pharmaceuticals and all the things. And a lot, you know, there's some beautiful children that are coming through unscathed, but even my beautiful child, like he, even though quite robust, was affected on this level. I think I just love helping people. I'm curious. I'm constantly looking for different ways to understand someone and prescribe a remedy and all of that kind of thing.
Awesome. So that's, well, it's very, I can feel the passion sitting here as we talk, and I've felt the progress, right? I've seen my kids recover from things very fast, and it resonates very strong with me, the idea of like a parent being able to say, oh my gosh, I feel like I have my child back. That would be such a powerful reason to get up every day and start taking consults and figuring stuff out for people.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, final question is, where, if someone wants to reach out and get in touch, how do they do that?
Mm-hmm. So my practice, I have two clinics, one in Australia and one that's US based. In Australia, it's called The Family Apothecary. And you can Google that, The Family Apothecary Clinic.
We'll link the website in our show notes and stuff. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. And then we have Homeopathy Hive in the US, which is a clinic solely based on working with complex pediatric cases and their families. And we see people all over the world. From both the clinics, we see people from all over the world. And awesome. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your help with my family, and thank you for joining today.
Thanks, Jake. And I will say that, you know, you and your family, like you are kind of carving a new way forward, I think, against all of these things. You and Lauren totally have been guided, I think, to really change things up and heal your family and heal your ancestors and also, you know, live in this world in a better way. So thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. No, it means a lot. And it's, yeah, as a final comment, I guess the support team that we're building around ourselves as a couple for our kids and for ourselves is very, very important to us. That's what the podcast is all about. It's like investing in things that aren't all that obvious, that bring you happiness, they bring you health. And I actually shout out to Dr. Max, who once at a Bitcoin conference was like, what's the point of multi-generational wealth if you don't have multi-generational health? And it's absolutely on point. Like, why did my father die when he was 48 years old? Like, he missed half his life. But that sucks. We don't want that to happen again. Let's ask the right questions to make sure that's the case. Oh, whoa. Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much, Sarah. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jake.